welcome to this departmental talk. It's my pleasure to introduce the speaker, Edoardo Airoldi. He is faculty at Harvard. He has a PhD from Carnegie Mellon on statistical machine learning and a postdoc from Princeton. And he's going to talk about statistical method for complex network analysis. So very interesting topic.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you about my research. Let me just get started. So the context of the research here, in many applications, and I do a lot of applied work with lots of data, we collect data, and the data involve networks. What I mean by networks, I mean measurements on pairs of units. So if units of analysis are your individuals or your proteins, then any measurements that takes into account both units will give you will give you a collection of interactions, and we can represent this interaction by means of a network. And there's different types of networks: weighted networks, directed networks, undirected networks. And we'll see some of these during the talk today, and we'll see some of the methods, the statistical methods that we can use to analyze them today as well. So I'm going to give you a semi-technical overview of some of the statistical problems that come up when you face a collection of interactions or a network. And then I'm going to spend most of the talk by surveying some of the network models that are old and new and are useful, and some that are not really useful. So I'll try to give you a sense of what models are useful where and for what situations. And then, as time allows, I'll talk to you about how to develop model-based representation for networks. I'll talk to you about a good idea, a useful idea for data analysis, which is the idea of structural equivalence. And if time allows, I'll tell you a little bit about how to study diffusion of information, for example, on a network. All right, so complex networks. So I talked about networks. Why this adjective complex is just an adjective or so what? So the idea is that we have two sources of information, and we're going to have to do some data fusion. The first source of information are these measurements on pairs of units, and the second source of information are unit-specific attributes. So you can think about individuals. Individuals interact, and you know who interacted with whom. And you also measure characteristics about these individuals, perhaps what they care about, demographics, and so on and so forth. And so this is sort of the data that we face in practice. And also traditionally, you can always, you only had to choose two out of these three characteristics of the data. Either you had the realistic network, meaning the data were not simulated and completely mapped, so you could have a realistic network that was completely mapped, or you could have a very large scale network which was completely mapped, but perhaps it was made of simulated data. Whereas today, with today's technology, we have the ability to collect and study large scale networks on real phenomena that are completely mapped. And I'll give you a few examples that I'm sure everyone is familiar with, and I'm just going to list them here. For example, in my lab, we're studying these days cell phone data, in particular with in collaboration with AT&T. And we're working with LinkedIn and Facebook to analyze some of these friendship online friendship networks and online interactions. But all of these systems are available to pretty much anyone who can write a crawler and is willing to spend some time and some money to download and store them. Another question that often, at least in the past, I had to argue about is why complex networks and why now? And the answer is that, really, although a lot of people tend to think that networks are the next revolution, in reality, there's a long history of analysis of network data in the sciences. And on top of that, although people maybe today talk about relational data and so on and so forth, if you think about weather forecasts or epidemics, these are old or classical problems that also involved some sort of measurements on pair of attributes. So there's nothing really new. And so I just want to have here a slide to tell you about some of my favorite papers and what are the ideas that we think are useful come from a historical perspective. So in 1934, Moreno formalized the sociogram for the first time. There was a journal Sociometry in 1937 that nowadays is no longer active. In the 50s, sociologists started studying diffusion. For example, in this paper, Coleman et al. 1957 is a paper about the diffusion of information among physicians. So these guys were studying physicians in four different cities, and they were looking at which drugs each physician was prescribing and which physician, which sets of physicians any one physician would go to for advice. And so if physician A starts prescribing drugs 1, 2, and 3 and then talks to physicians B, C, and D, perhaps they can also start prescribing this drug because they trust their colleague. And so if you think about this very interesting model of diffusion where there's some sort of beginning state and then there's an exponential growth and then there's like some saturation effect, those curves and the differential equations that were used to derive those curves were actually in this paper in 1957. And then in the 50s and in the 60s, mathematicians and psychologists started working on networks. So the famous papers by Erdos and Rennie on the emergence of the giant component, a less known paper by Gilbert who developed the probabilistic model that Erdos and Rennie studied, and if I'll have a slide later on to sort of show you how is this model of Gilbert, who poor guy gets no credit, everyone is actually using these days. Milgram did this famous study on the small world or 6 degrees of separation. Statisticians started looking at data in the 70s, and computer scientists and physicists started sort of looking in, at networks in the 90s. And in particular, there's this paper, Falutzos, 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 three brothers who studied the scaling, the power law in the internet routing, and then more famous papers by Albert and Barabasi and Huberman and Lada Adamich. Okay, I should answer to this. Okay, so some of the issues here that some of you may have encountered is it's easy to measure things, so it's easy to crawl the internet or crawl Facebook or you know dump Wikipedia, but it's hard to pose the right question. So oftentimes it happens that you come across a data set that looks very interesting, but then you cannot really ask an intelligent question. So in statistical network analysis or in general, it's always good to start from a question and then move on. There's also this second bullet, which is one of my favorite, is what does yij equals zero mean? So y here is an adjacency matrix. So I have individual I and individual j, and if yij equals 1, means that there's an interaction between individual I and individual j. So I'll show you an example later on, and what happens is oftentimes if you have a 0 in your adjacency matrix, that doesn't mean that a measurement was taken. And so if your matrix is sparse, it doesn't really mean that your model should take into account all the zeros that are in the matrix. And a lot of these models that are available out there in the software are sort of agnostic to what ones and zeros mean, and so it's up to the researcher to try and think about whether the zeros should be used to make inference on the parameters or to the zero, whether the zeros bear relevance to the conclusions. And then there's other issues and maybe we'll talk about, maybe not. One important issue is this notion of variability, however. So if you think about the typical setting where you have, let's say, a regression setting. So you have a y, an observed response, and you have a vector of x's for every person. And these vectors of X's are IID. So when you look for what's the R square of your regression, or what's the variability of the parameter that they were trying to estimate, well, the variability is the variability across individuals, because you measure these vectors, X's, across individuals, and there's some notion of variability of a parameter or characteristics across individuals. What happens in networks, oftentimes you see one network. So instead of having these vector-valued measurements, you have a matrix-valued measurement, but you only have one. So the variability that we're talking about in this model is not sampling variability, but is variability due to dependence. Okay? It's the same conceptual exercise as if I gave you one vector of characteristics on one individual only, and I would ask you to run a regression. Well, how do you run a regression with one point? Well, that's kind of difficult. But same thing happens in time series. You have only one time series, and you still fit a model. And so the way you fit the model to a time series, you pretend that somehow there's some ergodicity property or the time series is stable, then you can collapse the time series and estimate some variability. Okay, so in network analysis, there's no notion of ergodicity yet. Nobody has put it forward. Nobody has studied it. So it's sort of unclear when people talk about p-values or when people say, oh, does my data look like it's coming from this model? Is my data coming from a small world network or is my data coming from a scale-free network? Well, those questions are resolved in terms of p-values, but the p-values really don't mean anything. So those are sort of issues that have to be thought about, at least. All right, so I'll give you an illustrative problem here just to make things a little bit more concrete, and then I'll talk about models. So a lot of time I spent working with biologists. So what happens here is a cell, is a eukaryotic cell. There's a nucleus. DNA gets replicated. These little strands of mRNA correspond to genes. They come out of the nucleus. They meet these orange blobs called ribosomes that translate a sequence of DNA into a sequence of amino acids. And at the end of this process, we get proteins. And proteins are the players in this in the cell. And the same way individuals interact and things happen in society, well, in the cell, proteins interact in different ways and function sort of happens in a cell. Okay, so there's different ways of thinking about function. In particular, what nowadays everyone is studying is function as pathways. And so what a pathway is, if this is an example pathway, this I think is a carbon metabolism pathway, where every node is a protein, every edge, directed or undirected, is encoding an interaction of some sense. Two proteins may bind, two proteins may exchange a small molecule, and so on and so forth. And this is a static representation of a dynamic process in the cell that will instantiate a function. And the goal here is that sort of we know that depending on how the pathway looks like, something will happen in the cell. So what we do, we perturb the cell in different ways that are not important for this particular example, but the perturbation will perturb the system at different levels, at the protein level, at the mRNA level, at the gene level. And then we get lots of data, and we try to do data fusion. And here is an example of a probabilistic graphical model where all this shaded node corresponds to data sets. One could be protein-protein interaction, transcription factor binding, and so on and so forth. And G, this latent variable, is this graph over here. And so the model has a latent variable, which is an unobserved or partially observed graph that's a part of the input in this model. Then you give to this model all these data sets, and then you try and make inference and say, okay, so given this perturbation, how do we really think the function is being instantiated in the cell? What individual interactions and what type of interactions and when are happening to instantiate this function? And this sort of biological example has similarities with any or many other network analysis. The goal of this experiment is to link local connectivity over here to some global behavior. Is the cell living or is the cell dying? Is the cell growing fast or is the cell growing slow? And so on and so forth. Okay? And so this is sort of something that it's of interest to physicists or to economists and so on and so forth. And models, statistical models, help us attack this problem from a number of perspectives. Well, perhaps they usually use statistics to denoise data, but then we will use models to represent local network structure, and different model will make different network structure more probable than others, and this is going to influence the inference. And then we want to quantify these local connectivity effects on global behavior, in this case, signal transduction. Okay, so I'm going to change pace, and I'm going to tell you first an overview of some of the problems that people are working on, and then I'm going to describe some of the models that are useful. Okay, so I divided these problems as you would in a statistics book or in terms of chapters, if you want. So the first problem is representation. And the idea is how to quantify effects of connectivity, as we were saying before, on a response. And people have used different model-based representations based on motifs, based on metrics, so centrality measure, clustering coefficients, density degree distributions. These are what I would call metrics or summary statistics of network connectivity. And there's models that will reduce a network to a vector of metrics. And then we reduce this complex collection of measurements on pairs of objects to vectors, because now a network is just a vector of metrics. And then we can do typical analysis that we know how to do. Or the spectral decompositions of a network, there's some of orthogonal basis or semi-parametric basis. And those are all different really approaches to the same problem of how to represent connectivity, okay? And connectivity gets represented in terms of parameters that you can fit from the data, and then how to quantify the effect of connectivity on a response. Well, you will just look at parameter values as the new x's and the response as the y, and you can for example, build a regression model, okay? Population model is what I'm going to talk about the most, I guess, today. And although I don't have time to talk a lot about data fusion because it adds a lot of complexity, a main distinction between the models of networks are models that allow or have a role for node attributes and models that do not. So since in practice it's useful to both consider the network and the attributes of these nodes, it would be silly to consider a model that for which you cannot use really the attributes that you have, right? Otherwise, all this network-centric perspective on data analysis is itself sort of pointless, because you're saying, well, I have all these attributes, and in the past we used to do attribute-based analysis. Now we do network-based analysis, but in reality, both the network, the connectivity, and the attributes are going to be important to solve your problem, so you should really look for a model that allow you to use both these sources of information. Another important problem is how to make inference from a sample. So often, we collect data. Okay? We assume that there's a network out there, there's some structure, and we cannot possibly sample, we cannot possibly have access to the real or the complete network, so we collect data to sample. And one example is here given by the Center for Disease Control in the U.S., that sponsored more than 90 studies that use this sampling mechanism called respondent-driven sampling. It's a link tracing sampling design where you basically need to access hard-to-reach population, drug injections user, for example, and you have access to a few of them, but you give them coupons and you give them incentive to sort of have them bring in their friends, okay? And so that's why the Center for Disease Control is sort of fund and is spending a lot of money on this link tracing sampling mechanism. But But there are big issues, and the idea is if you have, again, the typical regression setting, your sample is IID, okay, which means it can be the way you collect your sample has no effect on the parameter estimates and can be ignored. And this is some sort of well-established theory in statistics. However, these network sampling designs cannot be ignored. So if you try to estimate your parameters, you should take into account both the model that you're trying to fit and the way you're collecting the data. And so this is another big issue that people are trying to address today, how to correct parameter estimates depending on how you collect the data about your network. Okay. Good. There's other issues that are sort of important to keep in mind when you do network analysis. One is goodness of fit. And just to give you an idea of what I mean by that, well, so a lot of people use this Neumann-Girvan modularity score to find community. However, even if you knew exactly what the true community were, and I gave you an infinite amount of data, well, with the Neumann-Girvan modularity score, you would get different communities than what the communities really are. Okay, so this is an example of an inconsistent estimator. And this is a recent result. There's a paper in PNES in 2009 by Bickel and Chen, who shows you how bad this estimator is in practice. So we have to wait to evaluate, once we have an estimator, how good our estimates are. And this is a big, important problem in statistics, and people are trying to devise model-independent way to evaluate how good a network model is. Then, you know, complexity and model selection. I think I'm not going to talk about this right now, but another problem that's very interesting is, okay, if you knew the network at some level, well, how do we really study diffusion of information across the network? And there's two sort of perspectives. In the first perspective, in, let's say, in a communication network perspective, you may know at the company level, for example, what the routing mechanism is. It could be deterministic, could be probabilistic, and the idea is it's very expensive to inspect every packet and try to figure out where the packet is going from to. And so you want to use aggregate information, which is cheap to collect and doesn't really affect the behavior of the routers, to then try and understand and reverse engineer who is talking to whom. Okay? So this is sort of an interesting problem. Lots of people are working on. And then a second problem is how to combine local cascades to reveal global structure. So imagine, excuse me. Imagine you're interested in news and the spread of news over the internet. So you have this space, and every source of news is a dot in this space. Okay? So there's CNN, there's Reuters, there's blogs, there's New York Times, there's CNN, and so on and so forth. And now let's focus on one particular news. What happened to the latest bill about healthcare from President Obama? So it will start perhaps from Reuters or from Associated Press. And then at the second point in time later on, a second node, the second source of information will pick the information, will pick this news up, and so on and so forth. So if you focus on one individual news item, you're going to get this cascade where directionality is given by temporal sequence, okay? The first node, the first source that report the news is the originating node, and then you have this little trail across this space. Now, what if you measured or followed 15 million of these news? Well, you have 15 million cascades. Let's say maybe you only have 5 million or 1.5 million because you can only track 10% of these cascades, but then how do you combine all these cascades of information to see where the information flows from to, and depending on what topic, who are the sources that start rumors and so on and so forth. So these are also some problems that lots of people are working on. All right, so I'm going to skip this slide over here. So this is the first model, if you want, that is a good model to begin with, just because it's mathematical and statistical enough, and it's simple enough. And so the idea is how to generate a network on n nodes. Well, you go over all the possible pairs, and you just sample a coin with the same probability p. And if you get heads, you're going to place a link. And if you're going to get tail, you're not going to place anything. Okay? And so this model is called the GNP or GN theta model. And you sample all these n square pairs, or n choose two pairs in this case, from a Bernoulli with the same probability. Okay? Alternatively, so if you did that, how many edges you can expect? Well, theta times the number of coins that you're flipping. Okay, so n choose 2 times theta. If you set m equal to n choose 2 times theta, then you can sample from a different distribution just which edges should be on, given that you know how many edges you want. So these two models are asymptotically equivalent, just because the only feature that's interesting in this model is the density, and you made sure that asymptotically or in expectation the density is going to be the same. Okay, but what's good about this model is that you can write down the likelihood. It's very simple. And you can estimate parameters and so on and so forth. And so this model, the GNM model, is the model by Erdos and Rennie. And this GNP model, which is the one for which it's easy to write down the likelihood and that everyone is actually using, is this model by Gilbert. They were started in the same year. They're asymptotically equivalent. Okay. I'm going to skip this. A second class of model that dates back in the 70s is what people call an exponential random graph family of models. Okay. And the idea is that you're just using an exponential or a Gibbs distribution to determine or to define the probability of a graph. Here, y is the adjacency matrix. Little y is the actual observed adjacency matrix. And given some value of the parameter, this is going to be a vector in this case, a k-dimensional vector, or some a vector of some number of dimension. And here is the probability distribution is defined in terms of the parameters, and S sub k are statistics or characteristics of the networks you care about. And typically what people do, they decide with what characteristics they care about, and they just use them as data, basically as sufficient statistics to decide this probability, and this is just a normalizing constant. So here I gave you two examples. Well, in the Erdos-Rennie model, this would be, or to get a model that's equivalent to the Erdos-Rennie model, you could use your statistics to be just the edges. And lots of people are using today the statistics to be triangle, and there's a whole literature in statistics and social sciences on which statistics, which motifs, which connectivity motifs are more useful to study different models in different domains. There's also an alternative literature where basically you're trying to find, instead of determining or pre-specifying which motifs you care about, edges, triangle, stars, and so on and so forth, you can actually learn from data which motifs are more useful to fit your model. Okay, and see there's some references here, so you can go check them out if this is appealing to you. There's two sort of issues with this model. Well, if you have one data set that you really care about, this model is great. There's software to do diagnostic, there's software to fit these models. The parameter space is not well behaved. So if I already have let's say you want to generate all possible models from this, all possible graphs from this model that has both edges and triangles as your statistics of interest. Well, all you need to do, you need to specify the parameters, and then given the parameters, you can generate graphs from this model. However, the parameter space in this case would be theta 1 and theta 3, so there's two parameters. One parameter controlling how important edges are. Second parameter controls how important triangles are. Okay, so, however, this parametric space, this two-dimensional parametric space is not a rectangle, is not a convex space, okay? It's actually something that looks more like a triangle, or even worse, but let's say you can think of it as a triangle, and as you add the number of features you care about, this space, it gets completely screwed up. So if you have, what I mean by that is that as soon as you are outside some region that has this shape you cannot control and nobody knows what it is really, you get either graphs that are fully connected, so you're just a giant clique, or graphs that are empty. And so if you now think in terms of doing parameter estimates given a network data, an observed network, well, there may not be parameter combinations that generate that network exactly, okay, or that generate on average that network. And so that's a problem. And so that is why if you have one network, you can work very hard on trying to use this model to study your network. That's something you can do. But if you, let's say, are working with AT&T or working with Facebook and you want to fit this model to 100 schools or to a lot of cell towers, a lot of location, a lot of zip codes, well, then this model, the inference in this model cannot be automated. And so it, depending on really what you want to do, is maybe very useful or maybe very bad for you. Okay, but that's great software, so it's still something that a lot of people use, I would say. Then the second class of model that I'm going to introduce and then talk to you a little bit more about with some data and some analysis are these models which we call exchangeable graph models. So they're models, they're models where the edges are not independent, as in this Erdos-Reni random graph model. The edges are weakly dependent, and the dependence, well, I'll specify you exactly what we mean by weakly dependent, but the main idea is that if this yij is my adjacency matrix, and in this first network there's observations about me and I'm in row number one, if you do a permutation of rows and columns, and suddenly in the second, in the permuted adjacency matrix, my information is in row pi 1 and column pi 1, well, then the probability of the original graph or the probability of the permuted graph should be the same. Okay? So the idea is simply that you want a family of distribution on graphs or on adjacency matrix that's invariant to permutation of the nodes. That's all. Okay? So it's a very pretty or easy to work with notion at some level. And a long time ago, Hoover and Aldous showed us that if you want to, that all the possible probability distribution that are invariant to permutation can be expressed in terms of a constant, some node-specific latent variables, and some edge-specific latent variables. So I'll just give you quickly some examples. In this case, the probability of yij equal 1 will only depend on a constant. Well, this should be not there. This is a typo, sorry. Should be depending on a constant and on node-specific vectors. Okay? And so instead of having a probability of an edge which is independent of which edge you are sampling, like in the Erdos-Reni random graph model, the probability was theta for every pair of nodes. Here, the probability is theta ij. So they're all different probabilities. But the good thing is that you don't have n square of them, or you do have n square of them, but they only depend on n quantities. Okay, there's some sort of, if you go look through the details, sort of interesting. But the idea is that every one of us, for example, is associated with a color, and the probability of an edge between two people only depends on the color of these two people. Okay, and so the likelihood is sort of almost as simple. So there's now here, in here, let's not go through the details. There's some latent variables that you have to integrate out, basically, in order to get the likelihood, which is the probability of the data given constants. All right, and so once you establish this general class of exchangeable graph models, then we can sort of reconduce a lot of the graphs that have been established in the literature as exchangeable graph model. So the latent class model is sort of close to what I call the block model. And so here, this UI, these latent variables associated with each node, are just integers between 1 and k. And we have a parameter here a matrix, actually, of size k by k that is going to tell you the probability of connection between a node with integer ui and a node with integer uj. Okay, so you have k by k probabilities instead of having n square probabilities. The latent space model, instead, is telling you that every person is not going to be associated with an integer, is associated with a point in a Euclidean space. So you can imagine a 2D space. Every one of us has a location in this space. And depending on how close we are in this low-dimensional space, well, the closer we are, the more likely it is that we're connected. And the further apart we are, the least likely it is that we're connected. Okay. And then there's an eigenmodel where basically still you have a real-valued vector for each individual, and you have a matrix lambda that composes the two people values to give you the probability of two people being connected. Okay. And so the latent space model, which is sort of a popular model, started here in JASA 2002 by some statistician and has been worked on over and over and over, is just the second model. And I thought I would give you a little bit more detail. So the log odds, or the odds of having an edge between person I and person J, is just a linear function that depends on a constant and on the distance of these two people in this latent space. And the goal of the inference is, if I gave you a network, you want to infer position for each of the people in the network in this latent space, and that can be used for interpretation. That's what typically people do. Okay? And so these probabilities, the log odds is just the log of the probability yij equals 1 over yij equals 0. You can sort of work out that this theta ij, the probability of two people being connected, is just a function of eta ij, which depends only on the position of the people in the latent space, and then you can write down the likelihood in this form. Okay? And once you have the likelihood, you just maximize the likelihood to find both the parameter values and the position of the people in this latent space. Good. All right, so I guess I'm just going to briefly talk to you about the block model, and perhaps I won't get to the rest. But I really added a few slides to give you some background and some models, so I hope that was useful. Okay, so these stochastic block models, I can tell you a little bit more. So this is a picture that appeared in Nature a while ago, in 2006, and tells you how protein connect in a cell. So the idea is that in a cell, single proteins don't really do much. Protein complexes, which are cluster or sets of proteins, are really driving function in a cell. And so here you see every dot here is a protein complex, is a set of proteins. And these protein complexes are sparsely connected. But then if you zoom out in each one of these protein complexes and you see what's the connectivity between among the individual proteins are densely connected. Okay? And there's some other cases that I will point out. But sort of this is the data that we were trying to model at the time. And we borrowed this notion of structural equivalence from the sociology literature, actually, to model protein interaction. And so here, if you look for a second in this stylized network over here, I want to make a point very clear, which is structural equivalence and block modeling is not really trying to identify communities in the usual sense. Okay, a community of people, for example, is a densely connected graph. Whereas in this case, if you look here at the green nodes, well, the green nodes do not connect with one another at all, right? This is not what you would call a community. They're completely disconnected individual. However, they are structurally equivalent in a sense that they both receive connectivity from the red nodes, and they all send connectivity to the blue nodes. So they have the same function in terms of structure. And in a biological sense, you can think of this as chaperone proteins, which never work together, but they all help other proteins to fold and to bind. Okay, so this is some important aspect that distinguishes block models from community detection algorithms. And so you need two sets of parameters to establish a block model. First of all, you need this matrix B. In this case, we have three sets of nodes. And so this block model is going to be a 3x3 matrix. And the 3x3 matrix specifies the average connectivity within each block and across pairs of blocks. Okay, so here, the green block, in the green block, there's no connectivity because these proteins do not connect. And whereas here in the blue block, everyone connects with one another, so you have some average connectivity, and so on and so forth. And in this toy example, I'm telling you that there's three blocks. In reality, we don't know how many blocks there are, so the model will infer also for you how many blocks you have and what's the connectivity across blocks. Okay, so that's a block model. Then the second set of parameters that you need is a membership mapping. So the membership map will tell you, okay, now that we know how at the block level the graph is built, okay, this is a coarser version of the graph, which nodes instantiate the connectivity of which block. So in this case, the blue nodes will behave on average like the blue block, the green nodes like the green block, and the red nodes like the red block. Okay, so once you have this, in this case is a 9x3 matrix, okay, then you're all set. Okay, so here I have a 9x9 adjacency matrix, which is resolved into a 3x3 block model and a 3x9 mapping, okay? Just to be super clear. And going back to how we build exchangeable graph model, well, here these pi i's, or the UIs, the way we were calling them before, are going to be IID Dirichlet samples, and YIJ, now given pi IIJ, is just an inner product of the composition or the membership vector of node I, of node J, and node J weighted by the elements of the matrix B. Okay? Great. Okay, so what you can do with this? So I'll just show you this very little example because it's easy to put our arms around it. And then, you know, you can look at papers to see how these methods scale to millions of nodes. But the idea is in this example, there's 18 novices, monks that are trying to join a monastic order. And this person, Samson, during his PhD, stayed at the monastery for 2 years, observed social connectivity, wrote a dissertation about it. And so people take Samson anthropological observations as the ground truth, and then it's a simple data set that you can use to sort of study structural equivalence in our case or communities in somebody else's case. And so when you fit the block model to this data, you find that there's sort of three main factions in this monastery. Hard to think about faction in a monastery, but that's what he found. And so there's an older faction, if you want, more established faction. He calls the loyal opposition, Young Turks, the outcasts. And it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you read the paper, there's a lot of insights that you can get from the block model. But the idea is that the block model is going to give you the structure at a higher level than the connectivity of the nodes. And then, in this case, since we only have three blocks, we can also visualize each one of the novices in this three-dimensional simplex, where corners will correspond to vectors of the form 100, 010, 001, and so correspond to mostly unique membership to a faction. And you can see that if you draw somehow some confidence intervals that are data-driven, you will see that the idea of structural equivalence in our case is useful to characterize most of the nodes. And in particular, Samson, in his thesis, identifies these people he called waverers who don't really belong to any faction. And at the model level, 2 out of 3 of these people, with high probability, are not belonging to any faction although one is. Okay. And then what you can do, you can study dynamics of social failure using this model. In this particular case, after 2 years, the monastery is dissolving, and so that's the reason why we're talking about social failure. And we can explain social failure in terms of this inferred behavior of individuals, and you just have to specify a block model. So this last line is the block model, and you specify some sort of dynamic. In our case, we have this random walk in the simplex to explain it. And you know, you can have pictures like this where we'll tell you what the membership of people is over time and so on and so forth. And you can do this for example, AT&T data, or at least you can fit this model in 3 hours on a laptop for, let's say, a million of nodes. And the reason why I'm sort of presenting it here is that we have both C code and an R package that if you are interested in trying it out, then you could actually do it. Now, let's see. Now I'm going to jump. So I'm going to take 1 minute to tell you about this other problem, the information flow on a network. I'm just going to describe the problem, and then I'm going to point you to some references for our solution. But the idea here, the sort of the two ways I talked to you before about how to study connectivity, diffusion on a network. Okay, so the idea is we have a graph. Actually, let me just show you the graph. And there's localities A, B, C, and we really want to know how much information or how much traffic is from A to B, A to C. We want to know, or we want to infer these origin-destination flows. But if you work with any ISP or corporate networking solution like Avaya in the United States, what happens is that network engineers are not willing to place any software on the core of the network, with good reason, because if the core of the network works, you don't want to touch it, or otherwise you're just going to generate a problem for the customer and so on and so forth. However, both for security reason and for designing routing protocol purposes, it would be useful to know origin-destination traffic. And so the idea is what we can measure is not origin-destination traffic, are these cheaper link loads. So in this case, all the communication that goes from A to B and from A to C, it's going to be passing through this physical cable. So here, what we can measure is how much traffic goes from this node and how much traffic goes from this node to that node. So these are what we call the link loads, the aggregate origin-destination traffic. So you can think of time series over this network. The routing matrix is going to create, is going to mix and sum up and add all these time series. So in here, do I have another? So in here, this routing matrix could be deterministic or probabilistic, it's given. What you see are these link loads that are some of the origin-destination flows, and what you want to make inference on are the origin-destination flows. The only problem is that in this simple network, or in general, you're going to have order n link loads and order n square origin-destination flows. So it's sort of an ill-posed inverse problem that we need to solve. Okay? And so the way we solve it is by using a hierarchical graphical model. So this would correspond to factor analysis. This would correspond to a state-space model. This would correspond to the model that we've been using, which is at the graphical model level looks like a state-space model. There's always some dependence here between these parameters theta. However, the dynamic is nonlinear, and the distributions that we posit for this traffic is non-Gaussian. In fact, we're using log normal or highly skewed distributions. And then it turns out that using a two-stage inference algorithm, at the first stage we fit a simple model with some good properties, and then we use the output of the first stage, which is cheap to compute, to calibrate prior on the dynamic. And then we can fit a second model using, for example, the EM algorithm or Gibbs sampler or your favorite sequential importance sampling on your favorite Bayesian inference scheme. Then we can get very accurate distribution. And if you, in the paper, you can look at In terms of relative error, we basically cut the error down by 80%, which is non-trivial. And the method is scaling very well. And we are using data from Bell Labs in the paper, where they actually, on an 8-node network, there was a corporate network, they actually looked at the real origin destination flows, and so we can actually validate our inference and so on and so forth. So I guess I'm going to skip, and I'm going to end. And so in this talk, I sort of told you mostly about problems and issues that statisticians are working on when we face networks that look like data, data that look like networks. And in particular, two of my favorite challenges is that we have to rethink basic notion of variability and sample size. And so p-values, model selection, all these issues are important. And there's a lot of open problems, more applied and methodological. That's sort of like the first part of the talk. And then I try to sort of show you how useful this idea of structural equivalence is in analyzing networks. And I sort of was able to just give you a brief introduction to how we study processes on a network. Thank you.
I just would like to ask, if you compare biological with social networks, they're both perhaps generated by some source of information. So if you're talking about social network, that would be our brain and the interactions generated by the way our brain processes information. And if you would talk about biological networks, that would be perhaps the DNA setting up the basis about what would be generated. Could there be any sort of comparison between the two? And, you know, in terms of information theory, what is more complex in terms of...
That's a very interesting question. One of the things we're doing right now is trying to address that question. So we are working with Facebook, so we have these online interaction networks available to everyone. There's also National Study of Adolescent Health. There's our offline friendship networks between students age 7th to 12th grade. And then we're looking at biological networks, and we're looking at communication networks, and we're trying to study the complexity and see sort of, the question is exactly what you asked. At the complexity level, what can we say about these things? On the other hand, I also want to point out that it's not good, or I don't particularly favor a lot of these analyses where you compare networks blindly across domains, just because in order to study networks, you have to work hard on the models. Otherwise, you're just extracting information that may not be really meaningful. And so if you just have an algorithm, you try it on a million networks, then it's sort of hard to really say something. So it's something that I don't really do or I try to avoid. Although, from the complexity perspective, I agree that's a very good question and could be addressed. So,
I was interested in the latent space model. Mm-hmm. Have they ever been applied to the study of social networks? I'm trying to understand that if you project the nodes in this k-dimensional space, can you really infer something about similarity of nodes across other real dimensions, real world dimensions?
Yeah, that's good. That's a good question. So that has not really been done. So the only work that's been done by this by Hancock, Raftery, Tantrum is in Microsoft, by the way, and Krivitsky et al., has been to assume that there is some kind of clustering structure in the latent space. So people are not just spreading uniformly a priori. They're not expected to be spread a priori uniformly in this high-dimensional or low-dimensional Euclidean space. But then they never did the next step of trying to see what these dimensions mean. But another thing that this reminds me that these latent space models are very useful for is that you know, here the model is very simple. It's just distance, right? But you could imagine of having different functions of UI and UJ, each one weighted by a parameter, right? So you could have beta 1, F1 of UI, UJ, beta 2, F2, UI, UJ, and so on and so forth.
Thinking about generalized distances where you actually compute actual distance between people across different dimensions, like geographic distance,
right.
Work distance, cultural distance,
right.
And so on, and try to see if being close in this space means something in the real world.
Right, and so in that situation, what I would like to suggest is you may actually observe some of these characteristics, age, workplace, and so on and so forth, right? And so this model doesn't have to be a latent space model. You can force the model to take into account both the connectivity and observe the values for UI and UJ,
and then
feed the parameters and just see mm-hmm. whether these parameters are different. That's something that's not been done, but this model lends itself very well to that kind of analysis.
So this would be interesting to be done on network where we have several layers
exactly.
of similarity.
Yep.
And it maybe it would be also interesting to see what's the minimal amount of dimensions we need to put in this space.
Yes, well, you can do feature selection on your layers.
Are there any other questions? Okay, well, thanks again.
Thank you.